A Different Way of Engaging. Transcription poems by Alan Sutherland. From the words of Catherine Araniello. In Memory. Catherine Araniello. 21st of September 1965 to 25th of February 2019. Dream. When you talk about memory, I'll always remember this particular dream that I had when I was about 4.5 years of age, which was about being in a lorry with no windows either side, and I was being carted off, taken to a school for people with disabilities. Now, at that time, I had never known anyone with a disability or mixed with them. In my dream, in my head, I was imagining being whisked away in a truck full of freaks. And that was my sentiment at that age. And this was all because I was going to be going to a boarding school. Because my father was in the forces and there had to be somewhere for me to go. The local authority said, "Don't worry, we know where your daughter can go." And so I started off as a weekly boarder. I was there during the week, went home at weekends. So yes, I was absolutely petrified of being deposited in this unknown place at such a young age. First day. I also remember being in the playground of the school on the first day at primary school. I was crying profusely. And I was in a manual wheelchair, because in those days you had to wait forever to get an electric wheelchair. And I could never physically manage. I was never able to move in a manual wheelchair. And so I was in the chair and just sat there, because I'd been deposited in the playground of the school. And a girl came over to me, she was a bit older than me, and said to me, "You've got to pull yourself together. Otherwise you'll sink and won't survive this." Fatherhood. I think it was very hard for my father to accept that I was disabled, even though their first child had been born disabled, with the same disability as myself, and died at the age of 17.5 months. My physique then was very normal. I looked completely able-bodied, even though I was unable to crawl, or walk, or weight-bear, or roll over. But I still needed everything done, though I could do more then than I can do now. My father just couldn't accept that fact that I was unable to walk. So I remember him sitting on the sofa, and then holding me standing up with my back to him. And his belief was that, by letting go of me, I would naturally be able to just hold myself. And I fell flat on the floor. It's not something that I'm traumatized by. I understand. I get it. But that was just something that I very vividly remember. And I also understand that, because my father, I think that the particularity of my body didn't match the level of what I couldn't do. It made no sense to him, so he had to go through this quite rudimentary exercise in order to just be certain. Bedtime. I remember the summer of 1977. I was nearly 11, coming to the end of this school. We all had to be in bed by 7 in the evening. With me, once I'm in bed, I can't roll over or sit up, so I was literally bedded for the night, and it was excruciating. There was no way that I could sleep when it was so hot. It was light outside, and yet they were still putting us to bed by 7 p.m., and that was it. And there was nothing I could do, nothing other than communicate with the other people. But they weren't great conversationalists. So frustration was something that I really was experiencing at the time, like complete frustration. And maybe that's why now I don't even start to begin to think about going to bed till after 1 a.m. I'm a late person. I will not go to bed until I'm ready to crash. Because once again, I cannot do anything. Excursion. We went into the Sunshine Variety Bus. And they took us to the pond, so they had the ducks and the swans, and they were too lazy to let us out. We literally just sat in the bus, looked at the ducks and the swans, till they took us back. That's all. No wonder I turned out the way. My God, I mean, you know, it's terrible, isn't it? You can tell what I think about this stuff. It was awful. These schools are absolutely disgusting. Sort of psychological oppression. They were restrictive. We visited a shopping centre once. We never went to the shops. I was getting so desperate, I signed up to go to Sunday school. What kept me going was I had very good parents. They were in Germany and I was in England, and I'd only see them in the holidays. Manual. I also remember that I was desperate to have an electric wheelchair. I've never, ever been able to move an inch in a manual wheelchair. I wasn't one of those people who was put in a manual wheelchair, and if I tried a bit harder, I would somehow be able to move. I wasn't able to move. They had a rule that the more able-bodied kids weren't allowed to push the kids that were in the wheelchairs. So I wasn't actually able to move around. Until I was 8, I never experienced freedom of movement. Electric. At the age of 8, it was decided that I was old enough to be put in an electric wheelchair, and I was able to experience movement for the first time in my life. I had to basically reverse and go forwards between beds to prove that I was capable of steering the chair. And I think that also had an impact on me. I have to always be able to drive my own electric wheelchair. And that has been increasingly more difficult. But the idea of being pushed around like an ill person is just not going to happen. I don't want people moving me. Assistance. It was survival. It was like mental survival. You had to be mentally strong to survive at the school. And I remember a report that they wrote about me to my parents. Catherine excels in everything, but she does tend to take advantage of the younger children. And what they meant by that was, I, because I was physically not able, I needed things passed to me, put closer to me. I'd already started to orchestrate my own PAs, my little PAs. The more physically able children, not younger, assisted me, and that was a survival strategy. And they would do whatever I asked them to do. At tea time, they'd give us sandwiches, and we'd have to eat everything, even if we didn't want to. I hated the crusts on the bread. So I would eat the sandwich and then pass the crust under the table to the person that was my assistant, and he would scoff them. So I was really good at directing, really good at directing. It's like I was setting myself up without realizing it. I'm not saying that every moment was bad. I'm not saying that every moment was bad. It wasn't, but it was just, when I look back on it, I just think, what a crazy, it was just, absolutely absurd way of thinking. And I am a product of that school. And is that a good thing, or... I'm not sure, it must have had an impact on who I am now. Maybe that's why my work is, as an artist, very strong, very... Some might think it's forceful. But I did survive that primary school. When you're restricted in that way, it just becomes what you're used to. You don't necessarily challenge it or believe that it is wrong. There's a frustration building inside, but you're with people of your own age, so you make alliances. That is part of a coping strategy. So I became used to that existence and felt safe. But it was a completely distorted sense of safety. It was very institutionalized. Choice. You have a choice. You either become a victim and oppressed. Actually, no, that's not true. Not everybody does have a choice. I feel that I've managed to maintain a strength, a mental strength. I've always been strong mentally. Not always, that's not quite true. But I think that it was a question of it's not right to dwell on negativity. It doesn't help me, it just... It's like, for me, it's the opening of starting to just think and not feeling that you're on top of things. So the question is to turn the negativity into something, an alternative way of thinking, an alternative perception. Decisions. When I was 3 or 4, I decided what I wanted to wear, how I wanted to wear it. So I had complete control over, she would have to dress me, but I would be in control. And my mother, I remember her, she would sit me in the kitchen on the surface, and she would pour out all her problems out to me. I was very much able to communicate with her. I think that those two things, in parallel, helped me to survive. Burton Hill House School. It was huge and looked beautiful from the outside. Again, another school that was hidden away. Nobody would know it was there unless you happened to take the wrong route. And this school, I was there from the age of 11 until 16. And that school was another. I was there at that school for, again, that was a hideous, terrible, no matter how much. Every day was all about survival. I quickly realized that again. I could physically move around. I had an electric wheelchair. I was quite frustrated that all my peers had private wheelchairs that their parents bought them. But my father had always been quite shrewd with money. Just wouldn't buy me my own electric chair. So I made do with the one that the state gave you for free. School days. The last meal that we were fed was at 4 o'clock, and that'd be tea, and after that there was nothing. We used to raid the kitchen, and there was nothing in the kitchen. The actual way it was run was so bad that it caused people to act badly, not badly, but rebellious, frustration. At the end of the day, I mean... We used to wander up and down this huge manor house, up and down the corridors, going through the ballroom. It used to be the ballroom. We used to wander round there aimlessly, doing nothing because there was nothing to do. We weren't allowed to go outside into the grounds without permission, and that was it. So we used to wander round up and down the corridors. There was no encouragement to study, and we were boarders, so we didn't have our parents, so we just used to do whatever we wanted. Staying alive. I think it's something that a lot of disabled people experience, certainly then and probably still now, is that life expectancy isn't going to be very good. So that was stamped in an imprint on my brain at an early age, also by the fact that because I went to special schools, disabled people with Duchenne's muscular dystrophy were dying all round me. So I didn't want to be sat there thinking, I wonder when it's going to be my turn, my time to die. I wasn't really given any information as to the difference between Duchenne's and spinal muscular atrophy. They were weak and I was weak. Plus I was told by the staff, live for today, you could be dead tomorrow. And my parents were also told, you'll be lucky if she lives past the age of 8. When the other fact was that my mother's first child had the same disability as me, but only lived till he was 17.5 months of age. And then my parents were advised by medical people, wait 5 years and then try again. And so they tried again, they waited 5 years, and my brother came along, who doesn't have SMA. 11 months later, I do have SMA. It was slightly an improved version of the brother that I never met that died. I was slightly stronger than him. There are different types of SMA that you are born with. Expectations. Being told that I might die gave me zero expectations. The school that I went to, which like I said was a special school, there was no emphasis on independent living or what we might become. I don't know whether that was just of the time, or whether that was because I was in a disabled, segregated school for physically disabled children. There was no encouragement for us to be anything or achieve anything, because the mentality of the school wasn't about that. It was just about looking after us, giving us a basic education. While there was this knowledge that I could die at any time, so I eliminated all plans. Maybe get into another Shaftesbury Society home, where I can be with other people with a similar disability to myself, and be able to watch TV and go out. But that was it. That was my life's ambition. It was really right down to hardly anything. John Noakes Prize. I had no desire for education, because there was nobody really interesting me. I just found it really boring. Although I did manage to, I liked art. I did win a prize for the school, John Noakes Prize, where it was a national competition where schools could enter. And it was trying to get the kids to clean their teeth. So I did a really simple picture. Toothbrushes in a line, queuing up at a job centre. So literally a queue of toothbrushes and a door which said Job Centre. And then the slogan was, is your toothbrush unemployed? And I won it. So that was something good. Powerful Lady. I do remember managing to get into CB Radio. I called myself, my name was Powerful Lady. This was amazing. I don't remember what age I was, probably about 15. And this was like my something that I was able to communicate with people outside of the school environment. And I found it the most liberating, exciting thing. It was just amazing. I was communicating outside of this, you know, oppressive environment. I was absolutely addicted to it. That's what kept me occupied, just talking to all sorts of people, and not about anything much, but just, I don't know, it was just something to get access to another world. But I think I was always very nervous to meet the people that I could communicate with on the radio. Matron. The matron was an alcoholic. That's a true thing. She was an alcoholic. Maisie, her name was. Her background was that she came from a shoe shop. She became a matron of a school when she came with zero qualifications, and she was an alcoholic. I wasn't scared of her. I was just impartial to her. I could sense that she was ignorant. And she managed to put the fear to people being quite intimidated by her. and I remember once putting a Hitler moustache on her face, on the photo of her on the notice board. I couldn't physically do it, but I instigated it, and it was publicly on display. And she was absolutely outraged by it. And she could never prove it was me, because obviously I can't do it. So that was one of those moments where I was really very, very happy. So that was one of my triumph moments. She was absolutely determined to find out who did it. I never admitted it because, why would I? Good times, bad times. There were good times, but the good times were not made up by the school. It was my own mental state and being able to communicate. They didn't do anything to assist us to grow as individuals or encouragement. The teachers did a bit. I got on really well with the physio, actually. Mrs. Butler, I liked her a lot. I liked physio just because she was an intelligent person and communicated at a level that I appreciated. There were staff there that I did get on really well with. One of them was called Mercedes. She was Spanish, she was night staff, and she was great. She'd bring me in pot noodles, you know. She was a great person. I kept in touch with her forever. So I did have very strong connections with people. I certainly wasn't a loner. I was in control of my autonomy. But when I'm thinking back on it now, it just makes me really angry that such a place existed. And the Shaftesbury Society still carries on to this day on this premise that they are doing something positive. I wasn't very interested because it's absolutely not true. It's real-life oppression, certainly what they were doing then. I've always been anti-institutionalized environments. I just don't believe in them. I think they're dangerous places. Detention. They had a gravel car park, and I dared to drive my chair across the gravel car park, which sat in front of the main entrance. And I did drive my chair across the gravel car park down to the main gates. And again, the gravel car park was there to stop us being able to physically move. And when they found out that I did it, they confiscated my electric wheelchair from me, put me back into a regular chair. And I was a senior at this time. They moved me to the junior dormitory, and they wouldn't give a time as to how long I was going to be there. I told my parents what had happened. I said, I can't bear it. I can't move. But anyway, that situation lasted a week. Mum and Dad were really supportive. It was difficult because they were in Germany. Hatchford Park. I went to Hatchford Park School in Wokingham, and it was just completely different. The dormitory was beautiful, the food was fantastic. Not private, it was just liberating in comparison to the two previous schools. I was only there for 2 terms, but I loved it. I felt, I don't know, I was respected, treated differently, and treated as someone worth investing in. Whereas the Shaftesbury schools, they didn't see us as ever becoming productive, useful members of society. So the whole ethos there was just keep you safe. Well, that's a contradiction. Keep you warm and feed you, minimal. They used to create this pathetic little firework display on Guy Fawkes. We had to sit inside the school and watch it through the window. It was just ridiculous. Star Centre. Because I had zero expectations in terms of thinking about the future, I just didn't plan any sort of future. And there, I just learned to live. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I was ill, went into hospital quite a lot with pneumonia because I was completely abusive to my own body, because I just didn't care. I was there to have fun. we were allowed to go out, going to Cheltenham Town Centre. And that's where I had my first, quote, real relationship with one of the members of staff. It was same sex, so this had to be kept completely and utterly hidden. And I was very proud of myself because, despite being in an institution, I managed to have a relationship with a woman while being a student at the college. I was very discreet about my relationship that I found myself in. So yeah, and college was all about vomiting after getting too drunk, smoking cigarettes, and just using it as a junior social experiment camp. This is basically what I did. Getting out. I never envisaged myself working in an office, even though my mother was a top secretary. That just wasn't of interest to me. So what I learned at the college was, it was like just a freedom. You could buy a packet of cigarettes and smoke them. You could get onto a coach and be dropped off in the town centre at weekends. It was absolutely an amazing, empowering. At last I had freedom to move around a bit more like a normal person. That's something that I'd never had before in terms of when I went to the schools. This was also a special college for disabled people only. And that's where I learnt who I was, against the fact that it was still an institution and very shallow in its viewpoints. I had an elite group of friends that I would just be with, a very small group of friends. I was just able to come into myself there in terms of the right type of relationship. Independence. My biggest, most important on my agenda was always independent living. I had to be in control. I couldn't bear to be living with my parents. Because although, you know, they were very supportive, if I'd gone to live with my parents, I'd just kill them. My father, from the army, quite controlling, very dictatorial, likes to have things his own way. I wouldn't want to live under that regime. I moved into this area because my dad's last posting was in Woolwich. I was in a relationship, she came with me. That went wrong, I had to move. GAD. I met Greenwich Association of Disabled People. I went to their offices and said, they said, oh, hello, how can we help you? I said, no, how can I help you? What do you want me to do? So it wasn't like I was there to receive their help. I was there to see what I could do to be practically involved in something positive and progressive. I'd already sorted out my money. My dad bought a book on more like a Bible. It was the biggest book, a big, thick book about benefits. I decided very quickly that I wasn't set up to thinking about work. So what I'd do was screw the system as much as you could. Not screw it, but just make sure that I got every entitlement I could, but not through working. And so my father bought a book and told me what to do. I had to get accommodation because my parents would have said, oh yeah, Catherine coming back home, we don't mind. I wouldn't have got presented anything. So I had to have her, I had to make it look like it was a very separated relationship with my family. So that was my first priority. Get into somewhere in this area. Day Centre. I remember being made to see how many social workers could visit me. And I said to her, not for me. And she said, well, there's the local day centre that you could go to. I said, I'm a similar age to you. I said, would you like to be deposited? Is that all you can? Is that it? And I realised then that there was no point in doing anything through social services, because their way of thinking is so limited. So I went around the day centre when I wanted and when I felt like it. And I had to rely on these hideous turquoise buses that would pick the disabled up. And I just remember wandering round this day centre, about 17, 18, no, I must have been 20, thinking, what the hell is this? What the fuck? I couldn't understand what, for me at the time, was all these zombies walking around. There were some people in wheelchairs, and some people just who were thinking that they were somewhere else. And I didn't understand, I didn't get it. I thought, what the hell, what is this? What is this place? I hadn't realised it was a mixture of people with mental health and physical disabilities. So that was my introduction to mental health, and I became fascinated by it. It includes me, I find it interesting, so it wasn't like I was scared, I just was completely curious. It was something I'd never, ever come across. That was interesting. But apart from all that, I also started to, you know, analyse the whole thing. Realised that day centres were dumping grounds. We used to do basket weaving. There were all sorts of things. It isn't a day centre now. It's occupied by Guardian residents. Anyway, I went there for a bit, learnt some basic computer skills from a guy who used to come in. Separation. That was a period of time my partner had become quite abusive. She was in control of everything. I wasn't allowed to see the bills. I was literally just a cash machine that she could benefit from and do very little. It was really hideous. So I had to deal with that in a way that, again, I controlled the situation, found her a new partner. It was quite a strategy. At the time, it was very important that it wasn't made public. The last thing I wanted was the paparazzi, victim of an abusive relationship. So that was dodgy. I worked it out. Again, I worked out a strategy to encourage her to find someone else. And it sounds terrible, but I had to do it. It took me a year and a half to get out. When I first wanted to leave her, she threatened to commit suicide. I was too young to handle this nonsense, but my mum and dad were very respectful, just allowed me to deal with it in my way. And I think that, for me, I can deal with any situation, as long as I'm just given the ability to do that. When people start taking in or going over me, I find that very, very intimidating. Flit. There were really interesting people at the Greenwich Association, disabled people. Like Rachel Hurst, Anne Ray. Anne Ray was amazing. She helped me stop this bloody awful relationship. And it was through her wisdom and intellect and supportive measures that were about spreading right. And I did a moonlight flit with Anne's support and assistance. They found me a bedsit, a brand new bedsit. My ex-partner was asleep upstairs, because she never used to get up until the middle of the afternoon. I moved out, and I think that's when I started to take complete control of my life and start living. But, you know, again, I still had friends. She'd been jealous of all my old friends. But once I moved into that bedsit, it was like starting from scratch. Application. I became involved in GYPT, which was Greenwich Young People's Theatre. It was an accredited course, and I got distinctions, and they applied for me to go to university to do a BA in theatre, and I was turned down. All of them were saying the same, sharing the same sentiments, that while they felt I would very much be able to cope with the theory side, I don't have the physical ability. They suggested Grey Eye. I felt, no, I'm not going to be involved in Grey Eye, because I want to make it academic. So I wasn't interested in joining Grey Eye just to be in the theatre. I wanted to go to university. And that's what changed my course. I decided art, fine art. They weren't giving these restrictions that the theatre was at the time. And so that's how I became an artist. Guildhall University. I loved the foundation because it opened up the whole concept of art. I mean, it wasn't just this thing about drawing something, drawing what you see. I created a visual diary, visual reference scrapbook, things I was thinking around that I'd never considered before. We'd certainly never been taught that at any of the previous schools or colleges. The course for me was about creating a portfolio so that you could then present that to get onto a BA course. Mainstream, no special facilities. What I had was my PA. When I needed to, I would just direct her. If I wanted anything, get that stand, get that bit of paper, stick it there. So I was doing it, but not physically doing it, drawing. I could still just about move enough to draw a bit. I used to go to the life drawing, but I'd feel that all my people used to look like they were disabled. When I tried to draw able-bodied bodies, they always looked a bit disabled. I could draw. I was able to draw. I loved drawing. I took that course very seriously and got it, got the portfolio. Construction. When I went to the university and they accepted me and I started my 3-year BA, Fine Art, in this progression, I remember making a construction. I wanted to make a cube, a space in which someone, a transparent space which somebody could go into, and I wanted a breathing machine. I wanted it to be like a sculpture sound installation, so somebody could go into it and hear the sound of the breathing machine. So you didn't see it. It'd be just a sound piece. So I made this thing with the PA. I had no skills whatsoever in construction, and neither did the PA. So at first attempt, it collapsed. That meant I needed a hand to deliver my concept, because I was just hopeless. I just get that piece of wood there. Does that look like the same width as that piece? I wasn't doing it in theory, in a theoretical way. I was just looking at it and trying to work out how to put it up. Slapping. That video was all about presenting an image. If I think about it now, it was looking at inequality, the concept of inequality conflicting with equality. It was about presenting a black and white image where they were equal, neither was more equal than the other. And slapping, because we were somehow, there was a physical interjection running on a loop. I was looking at the idea of this is disabled people. Representation of disability, certainly then, always seemed to see people as the victim. I was trying to create a sense of there was no victim. There was no victim, there was no hero. It was a sense of equality in a minimalist state. It was saying something. And I think at the time it was really important not to. It's not about verbalizing it. It could be, as I was more of a visual artist, about trying to, you know, present equality between two people, one who's obviously physically disabled and the other person who isn't, and presenting that image, trying to. The concept behind it was to create an equality, even though the initial reading would be inequality. So I was trying another way of representation that wasn't politically charged. I'm not coming from a political standpoint, but more within the aesthetics of art, I think. And by not putting big statements on it, or charging it as a political piece, or turning it, trying to, you had to think, you had to engage with it. Representation of disability is often so charged in a way that one is told how to see disability. When you're not told, it's just there. That is interesting. And it throws people into a whole disarray, like, oh, this isn't a documentary about disabled persons' struggles. It purposely negated medical and social models. It's something like the urinal, you know, Duchamp. He took it out of its familiar surroundings. What's its purpose? You put it in a gallery, and people are mystified by it. Suddenly they're looking at it from a whole different perspective. I think that's what I was doing. Taking disability out of its normal surroundings, and television, and political and tragic documentaries, and just removing it to a place where it's in an entirely different space. And I won a prize. I won the end-of-year prize. So that was a proud moment. Out of the ghetto. I think the MA gave me, opened up my mind in terms of I'd already, in between my art at college, doing my BA, I'd become very involved in disability art. And I was aware that my work was effective in that environment. But I needed more. I needed it to be really critiqued. It would always sit with disabled people, because how could it not? That's my life, the background that I have. My work will always sit in a disability context. But I wanted it to be scrutinised more. I needed harsher critique. I wanted to make it somehow, get it out of a cliché. I wanted to lift it out of the ghetto and do it so that it was aimed to be seen for a wider audience. It was important for me that the work didn't become part of a ghetto. That was very important. It needed to get out there, and I wanted to push my mind harder. It's all very nice to go, oh, I'm a bit different, but it's not really helpful. I wanted to be critiqued. That's why I went to Goldsmiths. You ask me about my work. You ask me about my work and what can I make work. I think that my way of thinking about all of that is not all about, oh, I'm a disabled person. I don't think that. It's not what I think. It's not what I have. I just make work that I think is absolutely vital. And it isn't about preaching or trying to tell people this is what you must, this is how you should think, and this is what it's all about. My work is about presenting a piece of work and then putting it out there, and people can think what the hell they want to think. It isn't prescriptive, so I'm not saying like somebody, for example, like Matt Fraser, who in the past, his work was very much about trying to educate people about thalidomide. I don't do that. I'm not trying to educate people in anything. What I'm doing is something different. What I'm doing is something different. It's a different approach. An approach that I'm playing with people. I'm taking them on emotional roller coasters. Because I think it's far too generous to be explaining to people. You will never hear me say, I have spinal muscular atrophy and this is what it is to live with it. But it does enter into the work in a way that can't be so, it isn't going to relate to anything that they may have read or not read about, you know, the situation, be it disability or not. I think it's more open to interpretation if you don't stereotype your own work. That's not how I want to make work. I'm trying to make it more about psychology of what's unbelievable, and also a basis from a fun perspective. In saying that, it's not about eliminating anything. So it's not about eliminating disability. But it isn't about only people with some connection to disability will understand the work. Because I think once that happens, the work is restricted by who can or cannot relate to it. So this is why the work that I make at present is about, I'm trying to think of instances, it's about illuminating stuff out there, but looking at it from a fresh perspective in a way that is completely different. While it has me in it, it isn't creating a set of scenarios that are easily palatable by an audience. So, for example, Miracle of Life. I've literally picked up all the worst sentiments that come hand in hand with somebody who's weak and needing full-time assistance, can't eat very well or swallow. I've completely turned it to myself, presenting myself as a victim, as opposed to a heroic Paralympian, or this heroic woman with a disability who is so self-assured that she or he is telling people how we need to think and how discrimination is out there. And it's all wrong. I don't do that. I actually immerse myself into that fucked up position that society has on disability, and then intentionally ridicule myself to the audience, and then they are not able to do it, I guess, or are thinking, what the fuck is going on here? There's something not quite right, but I can't put my finger on it. Artists Talk. I was asked to lecture an artist's talk. I didn't want to do a straight talk. I refused to do straight talks. So I went there as a victim and presented everything from a victim's perspective. And that was the talk I gave to the students. They really didn't know how to respond or to relate. And a lot of them felt really baffled by what I was doing. And some of them got it. I don't make things easy for people. I'm setting it up to make it as if you are watching paint dry. So it's all contrived. Everything I do is contrived. So, for example, I would say, oh, hi, everyone. Thanks for being here today. It was a really quite a horrendous journey getting here, and I'm really grateful to you for being able to come here today, because I don't get out much. So what I do is I'm filling them with utterly regurgitated all the negativity that people have on disability, either consciously or subconsciously, spewing all over them. And that's how I would do that talk. What I do. I'm quite inventive in terms of I might have a piece of work for one thing, but I reinvent it in the workshop. So, for example, I had a film which is animated, got animation, it's still animation. It's about a stick person who's doing all sorts of things that you wouldn't expect a disabled person to do. It's very crudely drawn in Photoshop, under my direction. And it's of a person in a wheelchair doing things like they're shooting babies, running over ducklings, and they're all part of a charity, which is a charity run by Together for Short Lives. And we have this image of a stick person in a wheelchair with pillows on their lap. And the connection there is they're about to put the pillows over the baby's faces to kill them. So, you know, I try to make it as sick as I can. I'm presenting it as an artist's talk. I will say, you know, as an artist, I do a lot of painting. I stick the brush in my mouth or wherever it will go, and, you know, I really get a lot out of. So what I do is I create an inspirational profile for why I'm making work. And so actually what you're doing is you're juxtaposing the complete opposite of why you're doing it to what the visuals are. I present myself as this really earnest artist who's making work as a hobby rather than as creative process. And that's really the essence to my work. It's that completely just twisting everything around. Because to me, that's interesting and exciting about playing to those models that are inspirational and motivational. When actually I don't see myself as any of that stuff. I don't gravitate towards disabled people that see themselves as role models. I've done quite a lot of research on disabled people that do this, and it's just so hideous, so horrendous. I used to get my stimulus from the Disability Workhouse Cabaret. Now I've gone onto the internet and seeing really what I consider to be very misleading representations of disabled people. I find it all so nauseating. But that has also helped me to redevelop work that challenges those. It turns this notion that disabled people are iconic, in any sense of the phrase, on its head. because nobody will see my work as major art. It's just so good. Oh, that's really lovely. Catherine's really trying to say something here, because she said it really well. If they want to do that, work will never do that. Just can't do that. Sorry. I'm sick and tired of those strong, powerful messages. So I create a different formula, a different way of engaging. So I guess the viewer is forced to engage in a way, can't be so stereotyping. Does that make sense? Working with Aaron. I met him for the first time at Sadler's Wells, at an opportunity for disabled artists to pitch an idea. He was there with 15mm films, and I was there completely independently, doing my thing. But we were both coming from film perspectives. He really liked what he saw that I was doing, and so he, this other person, introduced us. And then I became the editor. He just liked my concepts, and he could see what I was doing. I never told him anything, he really liked it, and so he approached me. I didn't know who the hell he was. And I liked his sensibility. He was, intelligent, bright, charismatic person, but was really just completely clued in on disability stuff. And for me, he didn't form part of the ghetto. He wasn't confined to just disability arts. He was able to go outside of it and in it, and he's funny. I found his humour funny. And we weren't sat there for hours trying to educate each other. We already had that education that one needs when it comes to disability politics. Enough to be able to make art that fucks around with people. And I think that's how, we formed the Disabled Avant-Garde and we got commissions. None of the critics wanted to write about the work because they didn't know how to communicate about it. They could only see it through the eyes of sentimentality. They weren't able to see it for the art it is. And so it was very difficult to get reviews. That was the struggle. Commissions. To get work as disability art, it's not always easy, because to try to, our ideas are so forward-thinking, it doesn't fit in to the medical rules that people, whether they know that or not, are used to. I know someone recently who got a really lot of money to make a piece of work. And basically, it was about her pain and suffering. And that's what they like to commission. What the Disabled Avant-Garde wants to do, what I like to do, is make work that really doesn't embrace disability, in the way of saying, aren't we fantastic and aren't we great? And by showing this work, more and more of us are all going to become empowered, And just by watching it, you're going to understand our lives better and really that we'll become equal. It's just bullshit. Absolute bullshit. But it seems that commissions aren't, even with Unlimited, they're not interested in work that's going to create controversy. That's why they love someone like Sue Austin, who swims around underwater in a wheelchair. Disabled Avant-Garde. I think my work as the Disabled Avant-Garde is different from my solo work. I really like working with Aaron. It's just easy. He comes up with an idea and we both do brainstorming. And often he comes up with, with strong ideas. And because they're so good, I'm not into saying, oh no, why don't we change? Why don't we turn it into? It's just a waste of time. If the idea's good, then just leave it and get on with it. And so he's very easy to work with and 100% reliable. He can source anything, he can do anything. And so for me, working with him is a real pleasure. And because we're ultimately taking the piss, but Aaron's very good at intellectualizing anything that we do in a superb way. And I think that the work I do with him is slightly different. But it still has that same thing going through it, which is very much, you know, against the grain. Going against how society, the expectations that society holds in everything, not just disability. Dag's Spa. We had such a good idea for the Unlimited Round this year, and they just didn't even invite us to have a talk. We wanted to open up a spa in Spitalfield Market and have like a stall, like an area where people could come and be pampered by the disabled avant-garde. It was such a good idea. People would come in and we'd puff up their ego, and it was structured. And they won't work like that because it doesn't follow the strands that Unlimited are wanting to achieve. We weren't even invited for an interview. We were thinking about actually having our own spastic shop, but we wouldn't call it spastic shop. We'd call it something good. And we would come into this space, and it would be where it all went on work-wise. We'd have like little badges that were promoting the disabled avant-garde. So we're talking about using that aesthetic, to recreate a shop where you went into and it's all like... And it was like experiencing, I don't know, like brain-curling disability. The garbage that's out there and the trash that people can buy. And we've created that trash inside a sort of shop, like a Dag's spastic shop or something. I mean, I worked with Aaron very well. It was, at the time, it would have just been hilarious. We were going to film it a bit like The Only Way is Essex. Turn it into like a live sort of... And we were saying things deliberately to the public that were provocating towards disabled people. And again, Unlimited won't run that type of stuff. They don't want it because it's too... It doesn't fit within the very small alcove of what they like to commission. So I think when I do things with Aaron, it's, you know, it's exciting. And we think, if we're actually getting funding, we throw up very good ideas. I'm not saying their work is bad. I'm not saying their work is bad, but it isn't doing what the work that I would do, which would be actual completely different sensibility. And it wouldn't be work that could be seen as beautiful or celebratory. It's another type of work, but it is saying something. But as many people can't read, they won't be able to engage. That's why I think the live art scene is where I've sort of found my niche. I feel comfortable within that scene, knowing that they get it, irrespective of disability. Dag's Spa. We had such a good idea for the Unlimited Round this year, and they just didn't even invite us to have a talk. We wanted to open up a spa in Spitalfield Market and have like a stall, like an area where people could come and be pampered by the disabled avant-garde. It was such a good idea. People would come in and we'd puff up their ego, and it was structured, and they won't work like that because it doesn't follow the strands that Unlimited are wanting to achieve. We weren't even invited for an interview. We were thinking about actually having our own spastic shop, but we wouldn't call it spastic shop. We'd call it something good. And we would come into this space, and it would be where it all went on work-wise. We'd have like little badges that were promoting the disabled avant-garde. So we're talking about using that aesthetic to recreate a shop where you went into and it was all like... But it was like experiencing, I don't know, like brain-curling disability. The sort of garbage that's out there and the trash that people can buy. But we've created that trash inside a sort of shop, like a Dag's spastic shop or something. I mean, I worked with Aaron very well. It was, at the time, it would have just been hilarious. We were going to film it a bit like turn it into like a live sort of, and we were saying things deliberately to the public that were provocating towards disabled people. And again, Unlimited won't run that type of stuff. They don't want it because it's too, it doesn't fit within the very small alcove of what they like to commission. So I think when I do things with Aaron, it's sort of, you know, it's exciting, and we think, if we're actually getting funding, we throw up very good ideas. Miracle of life. But often, when you haven't got the funding, your ideas are smaller because if there are loads of restrictions, you have to think in terms of DIY aesthetics. For example, the Miracle of Life, which I've turned into a karaoke song, which I've used in my live art performances to date. The idea was eventually to turn it into a video, so that it would sit amongst the most awful disabled songs. The background behind that was everything on YouTube or the internet, everything to do with my disability, or disability per se, always has this sentimental music. And it's all this stuff, all these role models, or this guy that's got no arms and legs but does this song. And it was really terrible. And he's a preacher, he's a pastor as well. And so my idea was to create, to do a song called Miracle of Life, which I was, the words are just horrendous. I even paid a composer I'd worked for in the past, and he had loads of research material, to make me this really trashy, this really nauseating original soundtrack. I made a crowdfunding live, and I created this terrible profile about me trying desperately to get funding because I hadn't got long to live, and I wanted to write my last. And I got over $4,000, which I haven't even spent. It's still there waiting to be used. So what I say is I've set things up that were messing around with people's heads. I've put myself in a crowdfunding thing as a victim, and I wrote it from a third person. I got someone, I wrote it of course, but this friend of mine who's like me. I create these sort of fake scenarios. Again, playing with the whole perception that people have. You know, I can't say I don't use disability, but I just use it in a very contemporary way, as do most artists. And that is a piece that I use during my performance, but I will be turning into a video at some point. And the idea is to put it out there. I want more people to see it and believe in it. Working practices. When I'm dealing with somebody else, there's always a difference there. And I think that the disabled avant-garde, we're generally making the work where we have a commission, as opposed to me just churning it out. I think the concepts are always strong with Aaron. I think that the good thing about dealing with Aaron is that he's just another person to go through the process with. And that's really energizing. I think we egg each other on. And that's really helpful. Whereas, if I'm doing a piece independently, it is more of a case of, you know, you have to be more confident because you haven't got somebody else to. And as far as what I'm saying in the work, do the disabled avant-garde say anything different? I don't think it is. I think we're putting it out there, but in just a different way. Depending on the commission and what we've been asked to respond to. I think it's still, based on where obviously he comes from a different school of thought, he's a very practiced art performance worker, he's very disciplined, and he's absolutely, if it involves a dog, he will bark like a dog. And he really will. We're not talking about an actor mimicking a dog. We're talking about Aaron completely immersing his entire self into the dog Oh, my God, despite the fact that he cannot hear anymore everything. And also, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable what he does. And I admire the amount of discipline that he has. And I also recognise that it is easier for him to do that because he doesn't have fucking PAs, or carers, whatever you want to call them. So I think that working with him is really brilliant. But it's also, I mean, I totally, yeah, I love that he doesn't. It's not about acting. And I think there's a very clear distinction between what is acting and what isn't. So if he had to, whatever it took to get into the role, he would do without any sort of inhibition. And that's the sort of person that you, that I want to work with. And I really think, I think that I've learned a lot from him. But at earlier stages, so that now I'm able to just do something without, you know, I don't want to be thinking about, is this okay for the audience? It's nothing to do with that. That isn't the process. The process of thinking about a piece and get it, presenting it to where you want to, how you want to present it, but not actually taking into consideration the viewer whatsoever, other than, if I do this, will it kill them? I think absolutely that Aaron and I have never, ever had a conversation in which we are talking about how can we change the way in which society sees disability or whatever. It's all about, sometimes we do touch on subject matters where we have to at some point cut reins as to whether we could be offensive. With a commission, if we have a theme like a brief, then we can very much sort of bounce off of each other, come up with some very good ideas. It's like brainstorming. It's very quick. DIY is about speed. It's about doing it very quickly, as opposed to, you know, think about it forever and then making it. It's a very quick thing to do. Collaborations 1. I'm not totally embarrassed that I tend to have artists approaching me and wanting to collaborate with me. Artists with their own art, established artists. So that's very nice. I did a Battersea Arts Centre residency recently, and I had Ursula Martinez as my mentor. And she's done work, I really liked her actually, but she comes more from a theatre. She has done performance. She does do performance where she did a piece called Hanky Panky, where she completely strips down to nothing. She also had work shown at the Soho Theatre. I really like DIY, whereas she's everything sort of, she knows where everything is, and it's all very much more organised and structured. And so it's interesting, where I think as a mentor as well as Kim Noble is an artist whose kind of mental health, depression for years, and his stuff was really amazing as well. And it was really good to have them understanding my expertise as being encouraging to me to what I do and saying things like, you know, people like you need to do what you do. And I think at any age, it's good to get that feedback, particularly from people that wouldn't know anything about the disability art movement. So yeah, that was good. And so that made me think about maybe applying for some funding to take the show to the Soho Theatre. You know, is it something I could actually do? But I think I could. I think I would love to do that. The lights on and stuff, shows there. I would never fit into that mainstream theatre, but could potentially fit into Soho Theatre. Or Battersea maybe, Rich Mix, somewhere like that. Just do a piece of work that was really demanding for the audience to watch. You know, plays around and at the same time does have subversive humour in it. Like Miracle of Life. Collaborations 2. I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand my work or get it, because they come from a theatre background. And so they don't really understand me. And they start critiquing it and look on it as a piece of theatre. It isn't a piece of theatre. I just don't say anything. I just hear what they say and then realise that they don't really understand. Because I have people in the art world, in the live art scene, approaching me, but I don't really have anybody in the disability art scene approaching me to make work. To me, making a piece of work that's good involves a conversation in which you can connect to the person. If you don't connect, you can't make a piece of work, because you're seeing things with a completely different logic. Even though you think the person believes they're on the same wavelength, you can't make work with them.